Good afternoon, everybody. I think now that it's lighter, I will say good afternoon rather than good evening. We are into the post-season on Tuesday evenings at Green College. Beyond today's event, we've got two more post-season Tuesday evening talks or presentations to look forward to. This time next week, Dietrich Jung, who is a professor in contemporary Middle East studies at the University of Southern Denmark, but is currently visiting at the University of Victoria, will be here to give a talk entitled From Islamists to Muslim Democrats, The Rise of the AKP and Turkey's EU Accession. And then a week after that, on what will be April the 24th, Kate Colley, visiting artist and scholar in residence, with a collaborator, Mia Weinberg, will be presenting on mixed ability art making with a live demonstration in this room. Details still to be worked out, practical people, but another kind of spectacle on April the 24th. So you're all very welcome on those Tuesdays too. Now this evening at Green College, we have the pleasure of welcoming back one of the best legal brains ever to have been resident in these precincts. And happily, to introduce him, we have another of the best legal brains ever resident in these precincts. Jessica Rhodes has all sorts of exams to do. She's just produced a play. She and others hosted a fabulous Seder for the Gentiles last Friday, but she wasn't going to miss this. Over to you, Jessica.
Thank you. Everybody for coming. I'm really excited to introduce Craig Jones, who has been at the center of a lot of the most interesting legal debates of recent times as the lead counsel for the Attorney General on Insight, the Brazenwood Taser Inquiry, and he's currently working on the Missing Women's Inquiry. And for those of us who are interested in Green College lore, I believe he was arrested in connection with protests in 1997 for APEC, the Asian Pacific Economic Conference. So I'm sure for those of us who want to ask questions about those halcyon days, we can do that afterwards as well. So without further ado, Craig Jones.
I was just saying that I was arrested here. I can't get arrested in this town. I was arrested here in 1997 because we rolled out some signs on coat racks into the side of the road saying free speech, democracy, and human rights, highly controversial issues. But the coat racks upon which we taped our signs remain, and that's one of them. And in fact, you can go over and you can see the tape residue that's still there. So something of a historic artifact. I'm going to be talking tonight about polygamy, and I was reminded, and these are one of the many disconnected thoughts that I have in the course of a day, of attending a Katie Lang concert. It seems like decades ago, probably, because it was decades ago. It was her Ingenue album, and she'd just come out as gay. It was Commodore downtown. The theater was packed, and the front rows were packed with the entire lesbian community of Vancouver. It seemed that way. Very enthusiastic crowd. At some point in the proceeding, she stood up and declared that she had a confession to make. They might have heard something about it, but she had to declare that she is a Lawrence Welk fan. And the crowd went wild. I'm going to start today with a confession of my own. I am a liberal. And I thought that I might start with something of a definition of what we mean by that term, because I'm going to challenge you as, I think, fellow liberals. There are many definitions of the word liberal. And to the extent that the word is derived from the same root as library, it speaks to a certain mode or degree of learning. That is, liberal arts, liberal education. It comes from the Latin liber, which means book. To some, liberal means licentious or permissive. And that comes from the same Latin word, liber, which also means freedom, to be free or unrestricted. And I've always thought that it was both charming and profound that the same word means freedom and book. I've always preferred the definition of liberalism of Bertrand Russell, who considered it to be a state of free of preconception and dogma, that a liberal was one always willing to learn. A liberal, according to Russell, must always be prepared to let go of his dearest truths if the evidence pointed persuasively in the other direction. This was most famously expressed in a phrase attributed to John Maynard Keynes, who's reported to have said, "When my information changes, I alter my conclusions. What do you do, sir?" This view of liberalism, however, is not the modern mainstream, and liberalism has taken on canonical beliefs of its own. One of those beliefs that had become dogma by the turn of the last century was the idea that alternative mating or marriage structures are not axiomatically harmful and therefore should be a matter of personal choice in which the state could not legitimately intervene. So taking this to be true in the case of, for instance, same-sex marriage, liberal thinkers simply extended it without much further thought to polygamy. And I would like to think that if Russell or Keynes had held this position, in light of the evidence presented in the course of the polygamy reference, they would have been prepared to change their conclusions. And so my ambition in this hour, if you're skeptics, as I was when I began this journey, is to present an overview of the case against polygamy, the case against the sort of knee-jerk liberal or libertarian, civil libertarian position that polygamy should be permitted as a matter of human freedom. And before I do that, let me just explain what or how the polygamy reference case came about. As some of you probably know, the law against polygamy has been on the books, has been in the Canadian Criminal Code almost since Confederation, since 1890, actually. After the Charter came into force in 1982, governments all across the country started to look at the laws on their books and decide which ones could withstand Charter scrutiny and which ones couldn't, and of course they would repeal or amend those that couldn't. But the difficulty with criminal law is that it's federal law, but it's enforced by the provincial attorneys general. And what happened with polygamy was the provincial attorney general looked at this law and said, it's clearly unconstitutional. The federal government looked at it and said, no, it's not. And you had a bit of a standoff, and the provincial attorney general took the unprecedented step, it's the only time that it's happened in Canadian history, of actually publicly announcing that the federal law, the criminal law against polygamy, was unconstitutional, invalid, of no force or effect, and could not be enforced, and that the provincial government, the Crown attorneys, would not prosecute for polygamy. It was quite extraordinary. That was in 1992. And that was the position of the Canadian government, and there were many government lawyers and consulted lawyers who opined that the polygamy law was a violation of religious freedom and couldn't be sustained under Section 1 of the Charter. That changed, that official position changed when Wally Opal became Attorney General. And he essentially reversed it, and you've probably heard the story that he hired what became a succession of special and ad hoc prosecutors to look into charge approval with respect to Bountiful and the problems of polygamy. And in 2007, Richard Peck came back with the decision that there shouldn't be a prosecution, there should be a reference. That was... Attorney Opal didn't like that, so he sent it out to Len Doust, who came back with the same view, that it should go to a reference and not to a prosecution. And Mr. Opal didn't like that, so he hired a third, Terry Robertson, who then said, yeah, we'll charge for polygamy. That was challenged by the two defendants in that case, who were Winston Blackmore and James Oler, who successfully argued that there was no authority to appoint subsequent special prosecutors after the first one had decided not to prosecute. And so the prosecution was quashed on that basis in 2009. And that's where I became involved, because I was the counsel for the Attorney General in Blackmore versus British Columbia, which was the case that led to the quashing. And after that decision, we had the choice of appealing the decision and then trying to get back to square one with respect to a prosecution, and then sometime down the road arguing the constitutionality of it, or filing a reference as Mr. Peck and Mr. Doust had recommended. I had advocated since 2007 for the reference, and in fact I'd proposed with the support of my most senior lawyer, George Copley, that it should be a trial court reference. And the preference for a prosecution had always been, look, this is so evidence-specific that we need to have a full trial. We need to have witnesses. We need to have people actually talk about their experiences in polygamy. It can't just go to the Court of Appeal as a reference and have them decide on a dry point of law. But what George and I discovered, and going back and looking at the statute, was you can actually do a reference to a trial court, which would allow you to have all of this evidence. It had never been done in the history of Canada, and there's only three jurisdictions that permit a trial court reference, but no one had ever done it. So we didn't really know what it would look like, but eventually we won the day. We proposed it first in 2007, but then it went through the attempts to further prosecute. When they were finally unsuccessful, then the government agreed that perhaps they'd give this crazy little thing called a trial court reference a try. And so that's how I became, sort of by default, the counsel for the government, for the Attorney General of British Columbia, in the case against polygamy. So a reference case is a case where the government sends a question to the courts and basically asks for an opinion. It has always been done to the appellate courts, and it's a fairly dry, very perfunctory process, usually on a very simple, straightforward question. This was not a simple and straightforward question, so we sent it to the Supreme Court, that is to say the trial court, where we could, and where the defenders of polygamy could produce evidence. In the end, we'd heard from over 100 witnesses, in person or by affidavits, from all over North America. We had 44 days of trial, and the eventual decision was 357 pages long. And I'm probably not engaging in a spoiler when I tell you that eventually the polygamy provision was upheld as a reasonable limit, as a reasonable infringement on the freedom of religion. So let me back up to 2009, because when I took on this case, I fully expected to lose. I still wanted to do it because it was such a cool case. But I really expected to go down, if not in flames, at least to ride this thing down. And that was because, like the government lawyers and like most scholars who'd looked at it, I believed that the polygamy law was unconstitutional because I believed that it criminalized polygamous marriages even when they were purely consensual, involving only adults, and were causing no harm to the participants and the children. And I thought you couldn't constitutionally do that, particularly if it was a fundamental part of people's religion. And we had to concede that it was a fundamental part of at least some religions. And this was the common view at the turn of the last century. The Law Reform Commission of Canada recommended repeal of the prohibition in 1985. They suggested that the law was unnecessary and excessive. And I'll just read you what the BC Civil Liberties Association position was, because, as I say, this was my starting position, even philosophically. They said this: the BCCLA opposes the prohibition on polygamy on the grounds that all of the other alleged abusive and exploitive acts, child and spousal abuse, are clearly prohibited by existing ordinary criminal prohibitions, provisions which the BCCLA believes should be vigorously applied, whether the relevant relationships are monogamous, bigamous, or polygamous, mounting a fresh and additional attack on polygamous relations per se adds nothing to this equation beyond creating additional impediment to important human freedoms of association, conscience, expression, and religion. That was the prevailing liberal view circa 2009. Now, it was not the view of the American courts, who had repeatedly upheld their own bans on polygamy. The Utah Supreme Court, in a case 2004 called State v. Green, wrote this: the practice of polygamy in particular often coincides with crimes targeting women and children. Crimes not unusually attendant to the practice of polygamy include incest, sexual assault, statutory rape, and failure to pay child support. But what's really apparent when you go back and read what was written in that debate was that in the absence of objective facts, both pro- and anti-criminalization advocates were making very questionable assumptions. The anti-polygamy forces assumed that those harms that had been connected to polygamy could be generalized into an assertion that polygamy was itself the cause of the harms, or at least that it carried significant increased risk of harms. The defenders of polygamy said that these harms were independent, only coincidentally linked with polygamy, and in any event, shouldn't prevent people from engaging in polygamy that was not in itself harmful to anyone. Both sides premised all of their arguments on the idea that if polygamy caused harm, it did so only to those involved in a polygamous household. Usually this meant the wives, but the children were also recognized as potential victims. There was little or no accounting for the possibility of indirect or social harm beyond notional damage, such as diminution in the value of women's equality. It was interesting that the debate was different from most human rights struggles in the past. This was not a debate between those advancing progressive rights, if I can put it this way, and those opposing them. It wasn't a traditional liberal versus conservative battle. It was a battle among progressives on what progress actually is. Feminists, for instance, were torn, with some believing that polygamy was antithetical to the very idea of equality, and others suggesting that it was paternalistic to circumscribe women's choices or to assume that women in polygamy were powerless victims. And each side was accusing the other of being dupes for the more sinister forces. The apologists of polygamy were said to be doing a good service for patriarchal despots. Those who opposed polygamy and wanted to keep it criminal were also not spared. The American law professor Susan Drummond wrote an article called Polygamy's Inscrutable Secular Mischief, the title of which really said it all. But there she said, it becomes extraordinarily difficult to state what the criminal conception of polygamy amounts to, apart from a mechanism to discipline and convict socially and politically marginalized groups. So you see, once the decriminalization advocates had accepted that there are no inherent harms to the practice, then they tended to assume that the lowest and most base motivations that can possibly be conjured to explain an opponent's position, in the case of polygamy, it has been variously expressed as racism, sexism, xenophobia, simple unthinking prejudice, or disgust, must be the real ones. Some refer to concerns over polygamy's harms as myopic and media-driven. Others still accused anti-polygamy activists of engaging in the postmodern crimes of racializing or othering. On the other side, Professor Stephen Kent and others, who were convinced that polygamy was wrong, uncritically accepted very questionable facts about polygamy as well, such as that it led to genetic diseases like fumarase deficiency, which is known as polygamous Downs, or that it was connected with rampant welfare fraud. And I should note that the Utah Supreme Court's rather blithe association of polygamy with the terrible crimes it listed was based on nothing but a student note in a law journal. So I don't want to be too critical of those academics who advocated the repeal of the polygamy law. What they were asking at its root is not unreasonable, that there must be some objectively verifiable harm attached to polygamy to justify its prohibition, that it was dangerous to permit the state to rely on anecdotal horror stories to justify the targeting of a practice that was closely identified with potentially vulnerable groups. I agreed with that idea, and I agreed with Drummond's observation that one could look in vain for a principled articulation of objective harm in the cases that had been decided on the legal commentary, or on the legal commentary as a whole. But my main point is that by 2009, everyone was arguing in a complete factual vacuum because there were two great unanswered questions. Is polygamy actually harmful to its participants and their children? If so, how and why? And second, is there yet further harm to society arising from the practice that could legitimize its criminal prohibition? We knew heading into the reference in 2010 that these were the questions we would have to answer, because if polygamy per se was not harmful, we would lose. And frankly, if polygamy per se was not harmful, under the Charter, we should lose. Well, let me turn to the increased risk of harm argument, which is the way most people had conceptualized the harms of polygamy prior to the reference. The arguments in favor of and against polygamy have circled around a single question. Are polygamous households really worse than monogamous households? So our first challenge was to demonstrate, if we could, that they were. Now, obviously, it's difficult to prove because you have to rely on intercultural studies comparing polygamous and monogamous households within the same group, holding other factors such as level of education, relative wealth, and so on, as constant. Then you have to have some sort of measurable effect of polygamy that you're looking for. So some of the studies, found that the easiest thing to measure is child mortality, infant mortality and child mortality. And when these studies have been done, they do tend to indicate that it's much riskier for a child to be in a polygamous family than in a monogamous one. Why is this? Well, the obvious answer is the decreased parental and particularly paternal investment in each child. We simply cannot devote as much resources to 10 children as we can to 2. But of course, this would be an argument against larger families as well, and no one would suggest simply criminalizing having 10 or even 20 children in a monogamous relationship. But in fact, there's other reasons to fear for children in polygamous households. And some of the most interesting evidence in this regard came from the field of evolutionary psychology, and I'll be talking about evolutionary psychology a fair amount here. But Todd Shackelford, who was one of the experts actually for the other side, is a leading U.S. expert on domestic violence. And so they put in an affidavit from him, which is about a page and a half long, and it basically said, boy, there's a lot of domestic violence in monogamous relationships in the United States. It's really kind of bad. And we looked at that and said, okay, sure. But the question here really is whether polygamous households are worse, not simply whether monogamy is bad on some level. But the interesting thing is when we scratched beneath the surface of Todd Shackelford's work, we realized that it was entirely founded on principles of evolutionary psychology, and in particular was heavily based on inclusive fitness theory. And what Shackelford demonstrated was that the level of violence and the level of abuse within family units is heavily dependent on the degree of genetic relatedness of the people within that family unit. And so when we got Shackelford on the stand, it was actually quite illuminating because he ended up being more our witness than theirs. His research tended to demonstrate that people abuse members of their households according to their degree of genetic relatedness. Now, we might accept that step-parents, or that a child is in more danger from a step-parent than a genetic parent, right? And I think, you know, sometimes I ask for a show of hands about whether people think that this is 50% greater risk or perhaps even 100% greater risk, double the risk from a step-parent than from a genetic parent. They're pretty amazed to learn that the studies show that parents are more likely to kill and abuse their stepchildren than their genetic children by 40 to 100 times. The highest risk factor of domestic violence is the presence in the household of an unrelated adult male. And unrelated females in a household also present a higher risk. Studies from Australia demonstrate the subtlety of these genetic preferences and their effect on behavior. And this has been termed the Cinderella effect after the stepfamily conflict in the fairy tale. And it's not limited to violence. A comprehensive review of accidental deaths revealed a staggering statistic. Children who lived with a step-parent were 15 times more likely to meet an accidental end than children who lived with both biological parents. Incredibly, this risk was 8 times higher even than the rate of accidental death in the children of single-parent households, providing that single parent was genetically related to the child. If a child lived in a household with no biological parents, the risk of accidental death skyrocketed to about 38 times higher. When the study's authors looked at drowning in particular, because drowning is a type of accidental death that is closely associated with failure of supervision, the figures were even more extreme. 25 times the risk for step-parent households, 82 times the risk for households with no genetic parent present. It may be an unconscious realization of these risks that leads us to be so careful when we're assessing adoptive households. We would never, ever permit parents with a history of violent crime to adopt children. And yet we would also never, ever deny a person with a history of violent crime from becoming a biological parent. Why this extraordinary double standard, except as a manifestation, perhaps, of an instinctive understanding that an extra measure of protection is required from adoptive children? And my understanding is that as a result of the extra measures that we do take with respect to formal adoptions, that children of who are formally adopted aren't at any greater risk than children of biological parents. So very interesting, very suggestive studies. And so we said, well, polygamy introduces more unrelated persons into a family unit, increasing these risks. So in addition to the paternal investment theory, you have this other theory of why child mortality might be so much higher in polygamous households versus monogamous households. And that's actually what they found in the intracultural studies that were done around the world, that a child, is more likely to become sick and die in a polygamous family compared to a monogamous one. Now, this is where I descend into a bit of controversy. In our argument, we proposed that polygamy was an evolved human mating strategy that was, on some level, innate. So this raises the question, well, how does evolutionary psychology, this notion of an evolved strategy, account for the development of behavior that will lead to increased mortality risks among the children produced by that behavior? The answer is simple. For men with sufficient resources, the numerical advantages of polygamy outweigh the individual disadvantages. A man with 5 wives may have, say, 40 children. Even if half of them die, that man's genes will still be twice as successful as those of a man who has 10 children in a monogamous marriage and manages to keep them all alive. And so polygamous behavior can be expected to prove very resilient through the generations. This is borne out in a very recent study of Mormon genealogy. As you probably know, the Mormons are fanatical about genealogy because of certain religious beliefs, and they keep meticulous records about it. And so they studied the genetic fitness, if you will, of Mormons in the 19th century. And they found that it started with the observation that wasn't it curious that the wealthiest Mormons' children died at a higher rate than the poorest Mormons' children? And they said, why is that? And well, it turns out because the wealthiest Mormons were polygamous and the poorest ones weren't. Maybe I should just take a little digression to explain that in any polygynous society that anthropologists have studied ever, when we say polygynous society, it's far from being 100% polygamy. It's always only a few of the top men that get more than one wife. And I'll explain why it's polygyny and not polyandry in a few minutes. But the majority of families in any polygynous society are actually monogamous. And then the people, the men at the bottom of the rungs, if you will, are left without any spouses. And that's what begins to create the problems that, that I'm going to talk about in a little bit. So we did have pretty good intercultural evidence that there were problems with polygamy versus monogamy within the same cultures. But we also had to recognize that these studies were done among Bedouin Arabs in Israel, sub-Saharan Africa, and more recently in the Mormon population in the 19th century. This was not compelling stuff that could be easily holus bolus applied to a modern rights-based society like we imagine Canada to be. However, beyond infant mortality, the intercultural studies did also indicate that there were worse outcomes in polygamy for mental health of both wives and children, and education, among other things. But as I say, this doesn't get us cleanly past the constitutional hurdle, because an increased risk is probably not enough to overcome serious religious rights. People are allowed to believe things that put them at risk, and we had to accept that the risk-based analysis embraced the idea that there would be some polygamous relationships that were simply not harmful at all to the participants or to their family members. But what if we were able to prove that polygamy was bad not only for polygamous families, but actually for society as a whole? What if polygamy hurt people who had no connection to the polygamy itself? As I say, it's a less well understood fact that when we're talking about polygamous societies, we're still talking about mostly monogamous societies. It doesn't matter if you're talking about fundamentalist Mormons in Bountiful or Bedouin Arabs in Israel. In a polygamous society, the top men get more than one wife, most men get one wife, and the bottom men get no wife at all. What does this mean? Well, it means that in any polygamous society where there are roughly equal numbers of men and women, you're going to have a gender imbalance among your young. You will have more single boys and young men than young women and girls. And experience is teaching us, and continues to teach us, that this is a very dangerous thing. Because an unattached young male is about the most antisocial and destructive force known to society. We introduced evidence at the polygamy case of the effects of the one-child policy in China. What happened was that the relative number of males and females in China rose quite dramatically between 1988 and 2004 as a consequence of this policy, coupled with Chinese parents' preference for male children. The resulting increase in crime was extremely compelling because the one-child policy had been implemented at different times in different Chinese provinces. Crime would go up in one province as its heavily male cohort reached adolescence, but it wouldn't go up in a neighboring province, which didn't introduce the policy until a couple of years later. Then, sure enough, a couple of years later, it went up in that province too. This permitted those analyzing the data to be fairly confident that it was the gender imbalance that was creating the increase, exactly as psychologists, anthropologists, and historians might predict. And it was not just the fact of the crime increase that was bracing, it was the degree. The China studies indicated that a very small increase in the sex ratio of 0.01 led to a 3% increase in crime. If the ratio increased a little more, but not even to the level where you'd be certain to notice it in a room of boys and girls, say an increase of 0.09, and when I say 0.09, what that means is that the natural gender imbalance at birth is about 105 boys to 100 girls. And that seems to be constant. If you increase that to 114 boys to 100 girls, You wouldn't really even notice that in the kindergarten class. That would be an increase of 0.09. It'd be one or two extra boys in the class. However, when that cohort reached adolescence and young adulthood, you would have an increase in crime in that society of 27%. 27%. And the crimes being increasingly committed in China were not those associated with higher status males, such as white-collar crimes, embezzlement, and fraud, but rather those one would expect to see among the pool of low-status males who would be, in the evolutionary psychology model, genetically desperate as their reproductive prospects teetered between zero and non-zero. In other words, violent crimes such as murder and robbery. The journalist Robert Reich summarized some of the science that even in the 1990s supported the idea of the pacifying effect of marriage on violent men. He said this, "Fortunately, male violence can be dampened by circumstance, and one circumstance is a mate. We would expect womanless men to compete with special ferocity, and they do. An unmarried man between 24 and 35 years of age is about three times as likely to murder another male as is a married man the same age." Now, you might be forgiven for thinking it's a bit far-fetched to declare marriage as an answer to violent crime, but it is supported by every study on the topic done. Yes, you could argue that comparing the criminality of married versus single men is misleading because it might just be that criminals are less likely to get or stay married. But even studies that have followed men through time show that their individual criminality goes down when they get married and goes up again if they get divorced or widowed and goes down again if they get remarried. Marriage is a prophylactic to risk-taking and violence seems to work. There's a funny anecdote that we introduced sort of peripherally in the reference. There were a few funny anecdotes, but this concerns the Black September terrorist movement in the 1960s and early 1970s in the Middle East. And this was the real hardcore terrorist sub-faction of Fatah. And at some point in the 1970s, Fatah decided that they were going to disband Black September. But in the political climate of the Middle East, simply disbanding a very intense group of young terrorist men was not as simple as just sending out the memo. The usual method for accomplishing this sort of thing would be a series of assassinations, which tends to lead to a series of counter-assassinations. Anyway, it gets pretty messy pretty quickly. So Fatah took a different approach. Instead of holding a mass campaign of extermination, they held a social. And they brought all of these young men to a party, and they introduced them to a group of enthralled young women, and they introduced them as heroes of the movement, and they incentivized them with cash and jobs if they got married, and further cash bonuses if they had children. And most of them did. And every once in a while, Fatah would go back and they would test these. This is actually documented. They would test these young men with important missions, highly dangerous missions abroad. And to a man, the married men with families would refuse. And it's not really hard to see in our own lives, I think, if we want to look at anecdotal evidence, that we call it settling down for a reason, that there is a pacifying effect of marriage. And from an evolutionary psychology standpoint, that makes perfect sense, that men are going to be driven to risk-taking behavior to secure genetic perseverance in a way that married men may not, because it's in their interest to focus on their family rather than on taking risks to achieve a family that they don't yet have. So this unequal distribution of marriage opportunity, can you see how this gets a little controversial? In polygamy, guarantees that there will be a pool of unmarried, low-status males in society who should be prepared to take almost any risk to improve their reproductive opportunities. Robert Wright summarized it when he said, "A polygynous nation in which large numbers of low-income men remain mateless is not the kind of country many of us would want to live in." Now, he went on to say it's actually kind of the country that we already live in, given all the ways men get around the polygamy prohibition, serial marriages, mistresses, and that sort of thing. I'll get back to that in a minute. But that was the first inkling that had been accepted of the mathematical problem of polygamy. And we've all heard of the Lost Boys of Bountiful, right? And the Lost Boys in the FLDS communities in the United States that are turned out of the communities, or that are simply, it just becomes apparent to them that their prospects within the community are not there, and so they leave generally very poorly educated, very poorly equipped to deal with the outside world. And they've become, now there's a class action suit in the United States about the Lost Boys problem. But of course, Bountiful has the advantage of externalizing their harm. They can push out the boys. A greater society can't do that. And so you will have the attendant factors of antisocial behavior and criminality. You can expect that. But there's another aspect to the numbers game, and I think this is something that I can take some original credit for, if not discovering, at least for developing. And that was when I was reading my way into the polygamy file back in 2007, 2008, and 2009. I kept seeing these accounts of young marriages. And wherever you went in the literature, you saw this stuff. You can't read an account of Bountiful or the American FLDS communities without remarking on the youth at which the girls were married. But it wasn't just Bountiful. It was happening all over the world. I was looking at the immigration of Yemeni Jews to Israel in 1949. This was a group of Jews who had still embraced the patriarchal polygamy of the Old Testament, and they lived in Yemen, where it was culturally accepted in any event. In 1949, suddenly tens of thousands of them were transplanted to Israel. It was an extraordinary airlift. It happened in a matter of months. And at the end of the day, I think 30 Jews were left in Yemen, and tens of thousands, as I say, I think maybe 50,000, were transplanted into Israel. It was an extraordinary achievement. But at any rate, when they arrived, all the commentators started to say, boy, these Yemeni Jews are really interesting. They're kind of like us, except some of them are polygamous. And gosh darn, do they ever marry young. And you can read accounts of the federal government's Indian agents in their reports back to Ottawa from the Western Plains, which was then part of what was called the Northwest Territories. One Indian agent assigned to the Blackfoot First Nation complained to Ottawa about polygyny there in the turn of the last century. And I'm sorry, I've been blipping in and out of the term polygyny and polygamy. Polygamy is the overall term that means more than one spouse, essentially. Polygyny is the form in which a man has more than one wife, and polyandry is the form in which a woman has more than one husband. For reasons that I'll explain, polygyny is the overwhelming form of polygamy, and when most people are talking about polygamy, they mean polygyny. And so I've used those terms to this point more or less interchangeably. But this is what the Indian agent said in his letter in 1903 from the Blackfoot Nation. He said, there are instances here of parents selling, bartering, or giving their girls under 10 years of age to be the wife of men of various ages. Furthermore, within the last year, several Indians have contravened the law regarding polygamy. I would like to know whether these Indians are to be allowed to retain these girls as wives, and whether the Indians who have plural wives are to go unpunished, providing they refute, to discard wife number two. Other reports from the same period reported girls as young as five being essentially sold into marriages that would actually occur when they became teens. So you see what we're missing here. The Indian agent wasn't saying that the polygamists were marrying children. They didn't connect the two problems because everyone was marrying young girls in the Blackfoot Nation. But in these traditions, the Yemeni Jews, the Blackfoot, the fundamentalist Mormons, it wasn't just polygamists who were marrying young, it was also the monogamists. So people thought, well, it can't be the polygamy that's causing this problem. It must be just the anomalies of a particular culture. It's just a coincidence. And as I was reading more and more and more of these stories, and there didn't seem to be any society where polygamy had taken hold, where they didn't marry, by our standards, unusually young. So I was sitting there reading this stuff, all the stories coming out of Bountiful and Short Creek in the U.S., and I was reading Daphne Braman's book, which was talking about the Lost Boys who got expelled from Bountiful because there weren't any prospects. And she used this term, the cruel arithmetic of polygamy. The cruel arithmetic. And it just struck me. The child brides resulted from this math, just like the Lost Boys. Let me repeat. In a polygamous society, the top men get more than one wife. Most men get one wife. The bottom men get no wife at all. What you have is a marketplace severely short of wives. When anyone in that society looks to marry, whether it's a polygamist looking for his fourth wife or a monogamist looking to find his first, and of course many polygamists start as monogamists, most, he's going to find that there simply isn't anyone available. So where do they look when all the adult women are spoken for? They have to go younger and younger and younger. And the more polygamy there is, the younger they have to go. Men in polygamous societies, and I don't know why, I mean, this is probably so obvious to you, but I swear to God it was one of those moments for me. Men in polygamous societies don't go for 14-year-olds because they're pedophiles. Some of them might be. But they don't do it also because of some cultural quirk or religious imperative. They go for 14-year-olds because they've run out of 18-year-olds. It's a constant pressure in that marketplace to get younger and younger girls. Now, you notice that I said here men in polygamous societies, not polygamist men. And that's because in a polygamous society, both polygamists and monogamists have to go younger. That pressure is going to be across the society. This is a crucial point in the way that we approach the harm of polygamy because it completely defeats the good polygamy argument. For years and years, people had said, look, if child brides and polygamy are the problem, just regulate the age at which people can enter into polygamy. But the fact is that if you accept this analysis, the real problem isn't solved. Even if every polygamist in your society marries only 30-year-olds, you are still going to have the same increase in the targeting and the sexualization of younger and younger women through that society. Nor is it an answer to say, well, if the sexual targeting of 14-year-olds is the problem, then just enforce the laws against that. Because if you know anything about sexual abuse of minors, you will know that it's one of the most underreported crimes known to criminologists. And in any event, it would be harsh comfort for someone to say it's okay to rape a 13-year-old, provided that the person is eventually caught and convicted. So if this model is right, if polygamy spreads even slightly, girls will be raped and abused at an increased rate. It is a mathematical inevitability, providing that polygamy would manifest as polygyny, and I'll return to that in a minute. But to put the debate in proper perspective, against that kind of harm, what weight should be given to the rights of adults to marry whom they want, or the rights of adults to follow their own religion? If it really does lead to that sort of harm, then that seemed to me to brush aside all of the other concerns in the analysis. And I knew that no matter what route you take in the constitutional analysis, and we as constitutional lawyers love our little branches of this test and that test, if we could show that polygamy per se was causing 13-year-olds to be raped, I had no doubt that we could get past any of the niceties of the Oakes test. So I say, of course, if this model is right, well, how do we prove it? Well, a good scientific theory is predictive. So under the cruel arithmetic theory, what should follow? Increased criminality, violence, and antisocial behavior resulting from the cohort of unmarriageable men, depression of marriage age as younger and younger girls are targeted. And then the third feature of polygamous societies that we could expect is as a result of this commodification of women. And the great irony of this, you know, there's always a debate, the Chicago school economists would say, well, actually, you know, polygamy is great for women, assuming a sort of free marketplace, because they have a choice. right? They have a choice of whether or not to be to share a very wealthy man or a very good man, let's put it that way, however you define good, or to monopolize a much lower catch. And so it actually empowers them, and because they're the scarce commodity, because they're more valuable, then they'll be able to, in economic terms, sell themselves, if you will, for more. And we had a wonderful expert at the trial named Shoshana Grossbard, who's an economist from San Diego, and she studied under Milton Friedman at the Chicago School, and she said, you know, I started from that point of view, that actually polygamy in a free society would be good for women. But then as I studied it, and she studied it for 30 years now, she said, I realized that all of that was premised on the notion that women could capture the value, that women could take advantage of the value, and that it would not be dominated by the men in the society. But of course, even in Canada today, men disproportionately control the institutions to which women are subject. In other countries, it's even harsher still. But we said, and at the end of the day, of course, with respect to physical violence and physical coercion, men have the advantage, so they will seek to monopolize whatever is in value in that society, including women. So we said that the third effect of polygyny, you're going to have the problem of the lost boys, the crime and the antisocial behavior, you're going to have the increased pressure, the targeting of young girls, and then you're going to have these mechanisms that develop for the social control of women in all aspects, but particularly with respect to their reproductive freedom. So how do you prove that? Well, let me introduce you to Joe Henrich. Joe is in the front row, and he's actually our first, he was our principal expert witness in the polygamy trial. And he has the advantage, or perhaps the disadvantage, of being an expert in evolutionary psychology, as well as he's tenured in the departments of economics, and principally he's an anthropologist, believe it or not. So he was able to tie in all this stuff together. He's here at UBC, and you really should keep him if anyone here is listening. He was able to tie in this from the sort of micro level theory right the way up to all of its macro implications. I thought when I had this notion after reading the initial material I did that I would have to hire three expert witnesses to talk about these various levels, the anthropological and historical, the social theory, if I can put it that way, and the evolutionary psychology and cultural evolution, which is the other aspect. And fortunately, we found it all in one guy. And so what we did is a cross-cultural study of polygamous and monogamous societies, and it was one of the aspects of Joe's work for us, controlling for confounding factors such as level of economic development and even location. So we compare essentially countries and societies by their degree of polygyny. And then we say, let's look at all of these other expected effects of polygyny and see if they're actually correlated with polygyny. And sure enough, statistically significant correlations between polygyny and every harm predicted were found. Youth of brides, age disparity with husbands, criminality in society, and in particular rape, robbery, and murder, and the depression of every recognized indicator of women's equality, from mortality to fecundity to democratic participation. And this wasn't just Joe's work. The government of Canada had a witness of their own who developed the Women's Stats Database, 182 countries around the world, which tracked all of their recognized indicia of women's equality around the world. And they introduced a rating for polygamy into that database and said, well, let's see what effect that has. And when you looked at it on the curve, you know how they can do these things where you pull the line up and down on these things and see what happens with all the other effects. It was just extraordinary how much all of these things went up when polygamy went up. Defense spending, believe it or not, statistically significant correlation with polygamy. Now, you would think, well, that must mean that this is crazy stuff, right? But no, it makes perfect sense. because a more violent society is going to have to spend a lot more on security than a less violent society. If polygamy leads to a more violent society, then it should lead to increase in defense spending. And there's also ideas about what you're going to do with this cohort of unmarriageable males, right? One of the historical solutions to this problem is to give them all a gun or a sword and a shield and send them off into the neighboring country to rape and pillage. We can expect polygamous societies actually to be more warlike as well as more violent internally. So that was fascinating stuff. We had some important assumptions underlying that that we had to demonstrate. One of them was that all of the theory that derives from the cruel arithmetic presumes that polygamy will manifest as polygyny and not polyandry. Right? If you just pulled out the cork in Canadian society and for every man who got three wives there was a woman who got three husbands, then all of the mathematical effects that we would say you need to be concerned about would be a wash. So would it be polygyny as opposed to polygamy? Well, we know that anthropologists will tell us that at least 99% of all polygamy throughout the world and in the historical record is polygyny. We know that every established religion where polygamy is practiced tolerates it only with respect to multiple wives, not with respect to multiple husbands. But why should it be so in Canada? We know that there are some polyamorous relationships where one woman lives with more than one man. We had the Canadian Polyamory Advocacy Association appeared as an interested person, and they had an affiant. I won't say her name. I won't embarrass her. Anyway, she was a cheerful middle-aged woman who testified that she was in a relationship with two men. On about day three of the polygamy reference, she gave a big interview to the newspaper. And she said, oh, it's like going to bed between two heat-seeking missiles. And she's got kind of her two large husbands beside her. And then she added, completely unnecessarily from my point of view, and I'm the heat. So we knew that those kind of relationships existed, right? And they became, in my shorthand, the commercial drive threesome. What are we going to do about the commercial drive threesome? They're not hurting anybody. It's one man and two women. It's one woman and two men. It's three same-sex men or women. It's some weird combination of all that. How can we prohibit that? Isn't it unconstitutional with respect to them, even if it's not unconstitutional with respect to Bountiful? And if we took the cork off, wouldn't it be that we saw in Canada, the free love, you know, generation? I live on Bowen Island, for crying out loud, right? It would spread like wildfire there, I can tell you. But why would it be polygyny and not polygamy? And the answer had to be that the mating behaviors have a powerful evolved component. Polygyny provides a genetic advantage that polyandry simply does not. A man with 10 wives can expect to be able to have about 120 children. Woman with more than one husband could still expect to have no more than about 12, which is about the same as that she could have in a monogamous family. There is no corresponding genetic advantage to women having more than one husband compared to men. And in fact, there's a great deal of problems involved from an evolutionary psychology point of view in a woman having more than one husband from jealousy and paternity certainty concerns. But at any rate, evolutionary psychologists predict that both men and women would be more accepting of polygyny than they would of polyandry. Now hold on, you say, why would women ever embrace polygyny or polygamy? Obviously, we said it's catastrophic for women as a group, but not necessarily so in any individual circumstance. And there's an anthropologist who studied polygamy a lot in the States, Laura Betzig is her name. And her point was, look, would you rather be the third wife of JFK or the first wife of Bozo the Clown? Because for some women, that's a realistic, that's the choice, right? So the theory is that there is a reception for polygyny in our genes that there isn't for polyandry. It doesn't mean that it's destiny. And I'll get to that in a minute. We have a choice about how to behave, just if you believe in free will. It's not completely predetermined. We have a spectrum of available behaviors, but the spectrum will, under certain circumstances, favor polygynous behavior, and it will only very, very, very rarely favor, polyandrous behavior. The second important underlying assumption of our argument, the first one was that polygamy would be polygyny and not polyandry. The second one was that it would spread. That if you took the cork off and you removed the criminal sanction, that there would be more polygamy and therefore, in our model, more harm in society. And the counter-argument was, come on, this is 2011 by that time. We're in a rights-based society. People aren't going to fall for this stuff. So we had a lot of argument about whether or not it would spread. And we pointed out that, well, look, we're reminded almost daily of what the evolutionary psychologists call de facto polygamy, right? Newt Gingrich or Johnny Carson, high-status men who marry a succession of younger women, monopolizing a disproportionate share of the women's reproductive years, just as a polygamist would. The only difference, it's classic polygamist behavior, except you're moving from one to the other and abandoning. I mean, this was always one of the polygamists' arguments, right? Why should I have to abandon my first wife in order to fulfill my natural inclination to take the second? Well, that's not a bad point, maybe, in some circumstances. But we force this serial structure on those relationships rather than embracing full-blown, if I can put it that way, polygamy. It's a more restrained version of what we might expect if polygamy truly opened up. However, a realistic view of the anthropological and historical record suggests that in a society where it's permitted, some men will be as polygynous as their resources will permit. Winston Blackmore was a relatively successful businessman who found he could support 25 wives. Rulon Jeffs had about 75 by the time he died in 2002 at the age of 92. His son Warren had about the same number by the time he was arrested for child rape. And Rulon, Warren, and Winston were not billionaires, and they too practiced their polygamy in the middle of a rights-based society in which we all live. There are now reports of polygamy spreading among inner-city black Muslims in the United States. In India, where polygamy is legal for Muslims but not Hindus, there have been a number of high-profile cases of men who have converted to Islam in order to take a second wife, leading to widespread calls for law reform. Laura Betzig, who I mentioned earlier, studied six civilizations on different continents over 4,000 years, Mesopotamia, Egypt, Aztec Mexico, Incan Peru, Imperial India, and Imperial China. And what she found demonstrated unequivocally the power of polygamy when it's uncorked. Bhupinder Singh, the Maharaja of Patiala, married 365 times and housed 332 women in his harem. Make what you will of the fact that he died in 1938 at the age of 46. Kings of the Chu dynasty kept dozens of wives and scores of concubines. The Chinese emperor Fai Ti was said to have kept six palaces housing more than 10,000 women. Lesser figures, such as princes, generals, and upper and middle class men, were restricted to correspondingly lower numbers, hundreds, scores, dozens, or a handful according to rank. The Incan king in Peru kept houses of virgins with at least 1,500 women at his beck and call. Around the world, wherever wealth grew, so did the vast and profoundly unequal distribution of the most valuable thing of all from an evolutionary perspective, reproductive opportunity. Now, why the insane numbers? Well, it appears that an inclination to polygamy, like our taste for fattening and sugary foods, lacks very much in a way of a restraint mechanism. And for similar reasons, we need fat and sugar to survive and pass on our genes, and they were scarce in the environment, so our behavior tends to be that of unrestrained consumers. This was not a problem when we could not obtain enough food to make us fat. Now we can easily, and obesity is epidemic. If men genetically benefit from more partners, and if the usual restraints, environmental, social, and economic, are removed, it is not surprising that many will indulge, and some with the resources will become gluttons. The comedian Chris Rock said that a man will only be as faithful as his options. The lesson seems to be that some men will be as polygynous as they can given the costs, and these are not just monetary costs. We can see social opprobrium and the possibility of criminal sanction as some additional costs imposed on the practice. Let me return to Newt Gingrich for a moment while he's still in the running. Newt, as most people know, is on wife number three. His current partner is 23 years younger than he is. There were put it delicately, substantial overlaps in his transition from one wife to the next. This is classic polygynous behavior. Now, we impose the cost to restrain this extent of polygamy, for instance, by making laws that substantially reduce a man's wealth with each divorce. Tiger Woods cost him $100 million, I believe. And we criminalize economic abandonment of the children. But what's really interesting to me about Gingrich is the social pressure that's brought to bear. Everyone knew Newt was a rogue when he began his run for president. It was notorious that he had left one wife for the next and has supposedly brought divorce papers to his wife's hospital bed when she was recovering from cancer. They were willing to forgive him all of that stuff. Then, about halfway through the primaries, Gingrich's second wife told the media that when she had discovered his six-year affair with wife number two, with wife number three, that Gingrich had proposed an open marriage so that he could carry on both relationships openly and simultaneously. Well, this was too much for the Republican base, and Gingrich understood that if he did not deny the open marriage story, his candidacy would be over. The fact that he had flouted our socially imposed rules of monogamy could be forgiven. What he could not be permitted to do was change them. And this is just an aside, but I think the tale of Newt Gingrich tells us much about both the human drive to polygyny and also the social rules that have developed to restrain it. But even if you don't believe that polygamy could have had a possible appeal to ordinary mainstream Canadians, the fact is that we remain a nation of immigrants. And if polygamy were legal here, we would be in the destination of choice for those persons. France dropped their opposition to polygamist immigration, and within 12 years they had 200,000 polygamists living in that country. They quickly reversed the policy, but the deep social problems it created within their large immigrant population remain. Polygamy, if it is permitted to spread first among some of the most vulnerable populations in Canada, will do so. In fact, it will create new vulnerable populations. We'll be trading the rights of women and girls in immigrant communities for a small increase in the liberties of mainstream Canadians who believe they can practice polygamy without hurting anyone. The convergence. So we had this theory that polygamy would create these social harms, child trafficking, abuse, depressed education, and so on. We had this intracultural evidence that seemed to indicate that these harms were present in polygamous versus monogamous households. But more important to my mind, we had this high-level expert evidence showing the startling correlations with the predicted mathematical harms all over the world, wherever polygamy was practiced, in pretty carefully controlled surveys. What we didn't have was proof of causation. We had only correlation. Ask any scientist how you go from correlation to confidently conclude causation, and they'll tell you there's really only one way, and that's with a controlled experiment. The only problem is you couldn't do one. You couldn't take part of the population and make them live in a monogamous society and then take another part of the population and force them to live in a polygamous society for a few generations. Can you imagine trying to get that past the ethics board at the university? But we said, well, actually, a control experiment is exactly what you've had at Bountiful. That's the story of Bountiful. It's our petri dish of the harms of polygamy. Let me tell you the story of Bountiful very quickly. Most people think that the colony at Bountiful is some vestige of a pre-existing Canadian Mormon polygamy. It's actually not the case. Polygamy between about 1900 and World War II had been eradicated in Canada. None of the Mormons in southern Alberta, which is where they were all gathered, practiced polygamy. There are three reported cases, I think, between 1890 and 1923, and that was it. So it was gone. What happened in 1947 was a guy named Harold W. Blackmore started reading the original writings of Joseph Smith and became determined that polygamy was the way to go. He was in his 40s, and he started espousing polygamy without practicing it. He was excommunicated from the mainstream Mormon church and more or less thrown out of the community of Carston, Alberta, which is where the Mormons were centered. And he and his wife, Gwen, decided, she was in her 30s, decided that they would marry Gwen's sister, Florence. and that they would all move to British Columbia and that they would start a polygamous colony, more or less, there. They bought 80 acres, what became Bountiful, and they invited these other people from these coffee clutches that they had in southern Alberta, who were agreeing in principle with the idea of polygamy, to bring their, to get multiple wives and bring them all to Bountiful. And so that's what they did. They started with three or four families in 1947, quickly grew to sort of six or seven. And if you go back and you read, and you can buy, he self-published a couple of books, Harold Blackmore did. One of them is called Polygamy! Why and How to Practice It. And it's actually, it's charming. You read this guy, he's a nice guy. He believed in women's equality, probably well ahead of many mainstream Christians of his day. He believed in absolutely that polygamy should be entered into consensually, and in fact, he believed that it should be an agreement between the prospective wife and the existing wife that would then be brought to the husband if those two could agree. You read this guy and you feel a lot of sympathy for him. And so I asked the court, what would our experts have said if Harold Blackmore had come to them in 1947 with this idea of a polygamous colony at Bountiful? And they would have said, yeah, it looks great. You're coming and you're bringing your gender imbalance with you. And you're going to have challenges, and we can outline some of the challenges, but it's not going to be catastrophic. But then you're going to have children. And the children you're going to have are going to be 50% men, boys, and 50% girls. And they're going to have children, and they're going to be 50% boys and 50% girls. And if you want to maintain polygamy in that gender-equal environment, you're going to start to see problems develop. And you're going to start to see systems of control develop. You're going to start to see the increased sexualization and targeting of younger and younger girls. You're going to start to see, imagine it, child trafficking. And you're going to have to deal with the problem of the excess boys somehow. All of these things would have been apparent to the experts, would have been completely alien to to Harold Blackmore. And in fact, Harold Blackmore in the 60s was forced out of the FLDS because he bridled against these increasingly harsh methods of control. He dismissed the fact that it should be the prophet who assigned wives, and he said, no, this has to be done by consent. He was abhorrent that the men would get around and drink, which is, of course, against the Mormon faith, and basically divvy up amongst themselves at evening meetings the next generation of the girls that were coming up for marriage. So he left in disgust in the 1960s. But lived as a true believer in polygamy with his two wives until his death in, I think, 2001 or 2002. So that was that would have been the prediction of our experts in 1947. And two generations later, what did we see there? We saw two competing bishops, one with 25 wives and the other with six. We had a prophet of the church with 75. We had a teen pregnancy rate at Bountiful that was so high that officials found it hard to believe, to the point where they actually didn't believe it. Secondary education completion rates were worse than the poorest Aboriginal communities, even though Bountiful students, it's fairly notorious, tested in grade 4 as among the highest in the province. An interesting statistic. Over the 60-year history of Bountiful, if you were a girl growing up there, your chance of going on and earning a university degree were worse than if you grew up in Afghanistan, Somalia, or Sudan, literally. You had the expulsion or abandonment of the so-called lost boys to free up more girls for older men, and then you had the trafficking of teen and preteen girls as if they were playing cards. So this is what we said, that we were going to show polygamy in theory, we were going to show polygamy around the world and these correlations, and then we were going to show polygamy in practice. We're going to bring the witnesses. If we brought the witnesses by themselves, they would have just been individual horror stories. They would have just been atrocity narratives, as they were dismissively called by one of the experts on the other side. But in the context of the higher level evidence, they became convergent, and that was the expression that we constantly used. I stole it from Joe. Convergent lines of evidence. So we had dozens of witnesses talking about polygamists, both from fundamentalist Mormon and Muslim immigrant populations. And the stories they told of living under abusive patriarchal domination were amazingly consistent with the predictions made by the experts. What was most interesting to me was that even the witnesses put forward by the other side, who were representing the good polygamy, couldn't withstand very much scrutiny. They had anonymous witnesses at this hearing. One of the innovations of this hearing was anonymous witnesses. So we had witness number four, for instance, testifying anonymously, and she was the example of the good polygamy at Bountiful. She was a young mother. She was in college, finally. And to all appearances, you read her affidavit and you hear her testimony in chief, and she sounds just like every other 21 or 22-year-old young woman in British Columbia. And then we got to cross-examine her. So we asked her about the circumstances of her own marriage. Well, she was raised in the United States, and she was married a few days after her 17th birthday to a Canadian man she'd met only 2 hours before. She was then bundled into a car and smuggled across the Canadian border, lying to the border guards about her purpose for the visit, to become her husband's fifth wife at Bountiful. Then, 6 months later, her husband returned to the United States to pick up wife number six. That girl was 15. And none of this struck witness number four as causing any concern whatsoever. It had been completely normalized in the community. And it was so eerie. I can't tell you how eerie it was. The Chief Justice, in his reasons, referred to her testifying, and he said, with a calm that startled. And it was just that way. It was like one of those weird Children of the Corn kind of shows where everything's normal until it's not. And it was so fundamentally abnormal. I asked her questions about this 15-year-old girl arrives in your family, and I said, you know, where does she turn if she decides this is a bad idea? And she said, well, she seemed pretty mature, this 15-year-old. And then at the end of the trial, we started to receive evidence of what I came to call the Girls of February. Picture this. In the middle of the night, two men in Bountiful rouse their 12-year-old daughters. They take them on the road. They're ordered to put them in a trailer with a toilet so they won't be spotted if they stop for gas or rest from driving. They communicate with disposable cell phones. They take them to Texas and deliver them into the hands of Warren Jeffs, the sexual psychopath who was even then a fugitive from the FBI. Jeffs is trying to build a group of very young wives, what he calls his quorum of 12. So he decides that God wants him to marry them to himself. 12 years old. You had the Bishop of Bountiful, James Oler, who drove his two 17-year-old sisters to the States to be married to senior churchmen. Then a couple of years later, Oler was a party at the reference. His lawyer was right there. A couple of years later, he drives his own 15-year-old daughter down and sees her married off to a middle-aged man. And in the same ceremony, 13 minutes later, Oler takes another 15-year-old girl for his own bride, his sixth wife, brings her back to Canada. This isn't ancient history. The child marriages I've been describing happened in 2002 and 2006. So these are what I began to call the Girls of February, because we found out about them by complete fluke. You may have heard about the Yearning for Zion raid at the Texas ranch of the FLDS. They'd established it in Texas. What happened is there's a prank call. It turns out that a woman who seemed to have mental troubles from another state with a cell phone called the authorities and said, help me, I'm a 16-year-old girl, I'm pregnant, I'm at the Yearning for Zion Ranch, and I'm being abused. And, of course, don't mess with Texas, right? They came in with guns blazing, they seized all the children, they searched the place, and they found out that this girl didn't actually exist. Before they found out that the girl didn't actually exist, they found an amazing documentary record. They seized, I think, close to 100 boxes of documents from Yearning for Zion. 6 terabytes, is that the right word? 6,000 gigabytes of digital information they seized. And then they started to go through it. And so in February, when we were almost finished the polygamy reference, I get this call from Eric Nichols, the prosecutor in Texas, and we've been trying to work with them as much as we could over the last year. And he said, could you give me the birth certificate of this girl who we believe is from British Columbia? And we said, okay, we'll see what we can do, but why? And he said, well, she was married down here in Texas, and we think she was 12. So we got him the birth certificate. And sure enough, she was married at 12. And they found these meticulous records, the diaries of Warren Jeffs, who had performed all the marriages as the prophet. over a 3 or 4 year period. And they started to go through them, and we started to go through them. And then the story just started to come out. We asked them if their seized records had any more Canadian marriages, and within a couple of days we had 3 children. In a week we had 14. And a few days later we had over 20. We cross-referenced them with the birth records from BC, either when the girls in BC were born before they went down to the States, or when they came up from the States and gave birth here, then quite often as young girls, then we'd have those records. And we could build quite a complete picture between our jurisdictions of this trafficking effort. And what we discovered was perhaps the largest scale sex trafficking operation in Canadian history, right under our noses. By the end of the reference, we had compelling evidence of 31 bountiful child brides, 31 in a community of about 800 souls, in less than a decade. And those are only the ones, of course, that we found out about through the records. And all this was happening while many on the progressive left were assuring us that the connections between polygamy and the rape of children was all in our heads, the result of ignorance and prejudice. Angela Campbell visited Bountiful for a few days, and she talked to a group of women who it later turned out were almost all the wives of Winston Blackmore. They said, gee, everything's fine at Bountiful. And Campbell wrote a series of articles saying, gee, everything's fine at Bountiful. We just need to adjust our perspectives. We just need to be less biased against the other. She described child marriage as a historical phenomenon. This even as the 2 12-year-old girls were still children being abused in the United States. Lori Beeman, who was an expert witness in the trial, described the yearning for Zion raid in Texas as a failure to move beyond stereotypes. She'd written, "The allegations of abuse," this is at Yearning for Zion, "were largely unfounded. Atrocity narratives and stereotypes played a role in preventing state authorities from more carefully examining the allegations against those living in those communities." Atrocity narratives and stereotypes. And you can recall the commentary from the turn of the century academic literature saying that hostility to polygamy was really just prejudice, xenophobia, and racism. But we got to cross-examine Lori Beeman and Angela Campbell. And so under cross-examination, I asked Dr. Beeman whether she had actually consulted the 22nd December report of the raid made by the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services. I said, "Did you look at that?" She said, "No." She said she hadn't been able to find it. I said, "Well, I found it on the internet 2 nights ago, so why don't we go through it together?" So we did. What we had in a community of perhaps 300 adults, the Texas Child Protection Authorities had identified 124 perpetrators of child abuse or neglect in 91 families, which was over 60% of the families at YFC. In the 2-year window, 12 children between the ages of 12 and 15 had been married off to men as old as 54. The parents had stood by, or at least stood by, and perhaps enthusiastically participated. It was nothing short of institutionalized child rape in which the entire community took part. A dozen sexual assault charges had been filed, and by the time of the trial, there had been 7 convictions, and I'm pleased to report that just last week, the 12th and final conviction of those men was entered. In the end, we showed that the polygamy, we won the polygamy reference by showing how the theories of the experts played out on the ground. It's one thing to talk about the depression of age of marriage in the economic market for brides. It's another thing to hold in your hands the birth record of a bountiful baby, and you see the signature of the 50-year-old husband signing as father, and then you see the shaky, immature handwriting of the 15-year-old mother, and that you understand that the victims of polygamy in that instance are not hypothetical, that that was a real girl, that these things were happening, that girls being abused was not just a perspective, it was a fact. And here was our point. Our expert evidence demonstrated that all this had happened because of polygamy. And we said it again and again and again. Bountiful did not create polygamy. Polygamy created Bountiful. In this overview, I've only been able to touch on some of the evidence that was presented in the course of the reference. If you are still of the view that polygamy is unharmful, I would encourage you to read all 357 pages of the Chief Justice's reasons. And I would ask that, like a good liberal confronted with unexpected but persuasive facts, you be prepared to change your mind. Thank you.
I'm hungry.
Me too.
And why is she eating that stuff? She must have picked it up from her trip back home. The smell's making me sick. Don't you think she should eat it somewhere else?
No, that's disrespectful toward Parveen. Actually, I think it's great that we can enjoy different foods.
What would you do if you were this witness? Safe Harbor Respect for All provides diversity workshops across Canada with funding from the Government of Canada. Visit safeharbor.ca. Respect for all. Pass it on.
I can feel it all the way down in my plums, getting all swollen, with a light blue hue to them, fresh and juicy, ready for the picking. I want to bite into that plum and let the juice spill down my chin. You know what I mean?
CITR Campus Radio. Can you feel it?
I can feel it down in my plums. They're getting a nice bluish hue, getting ready to take them to the farmer's market. A special two plums for one.
And once again, that was Craig Jones as part of the Principles series that takes place every Tuesday throughout the year at Green College right here at UBC. So he was speaking about the recent polygamy reference case in the BC Supreme Court that took 44 days of hearing. A very interesting topic. Try and Polygamy was the title. We hope you enjoyed that. And for more information about Green College and their different series of lectures, including this one, the Principal Series, you can check them out at greencollege.ubc.ca, and they have a full calendar of events along with brief write-ups about all the different lectures that are coming through. So thank you very much for listening and for staying tuned. Up next, we have some music to take you out for the 4 o'clock hour leading up until 5 o'clock, when we do have our next program coming in, which is the Arts Report hosted by Megan. Following that, we have the Discorder radio show hosted by Wade, and further into the evening at 6:30 p.m. we have more programming for you, so and so forth. So thank you very much for staying tuned.
Mélodie, me fait de moi apprenti. Lorsque je me cédais ta haine, par mes efforts, chaque pas réussi. Quand il résonna, quand ta et chanta, le claquement des cordes me résonne familier. Si ce fut une chaîne transmise en langue, chaque ville neuve qui joua et celui qui resta afin de se transformer en chaînon. Je crois qu'il est toujours ici en quelque part. Et j'entends les voix anciennes chanter. Cette chanson ne se terminera jamais. Sa croissance dans les champs de progéniture. Dans les champs de progéniture. Où est la culture? Tu me demandes, je ne sais pas. Où est le futur? Tu me demandes, je ne sais pas. Enfermé dans la glace et Dieu sur les chiffres, j'entends à peine le battement de son cœur. Il est là sous la neige, je mer. Et où est l'histoire? Où sont les souvenirs? Où se trouve le langage que je connais? Enfermé dans la glace, est-il sur les chiffres? Si léger est le battement sans cœur? Il est là sous la neige, je l'espère. Et j'entends les voix anciennes chanter ces chansons qui se finiront jamais. Depuis longtemps, il continue sa croissance dans les champs.